Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
What is the role of automation in war? To answer this question and more, I am joined this episode by Elke Schwartz to discuss the role of automated technologies, including the increasing use of artificial intelligence in the pursuit of military objectives and the ethics of outsourcing military decision-making. Elke Schwartz is Professor of Political Theory at Queen Mary University of London. Her work focuses on the nexus of ethics, technology, politics, and warfare, with a specific emphasis on new and emerging military technologies, including military artificial intelligence, autonomous weapon systems, drones, and robots. She is the author of Death Machines, The Ethics of Violent Technologies, published by Manchester University Press, and her work on military AI and autonomous weapon systems has been widely published in a range of international publications. She is vice chair of the International Committee of Robot Arms Control and an associate of the Imperial War Museum and a Royal Society of Arts Fellow. Welcome to the Voices podcast, Elke. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Very welcome. So I'm sure our listeners are aware of the growing role of automation in warfare, not least because of the US's Project Maven, automation's recent use in Israel's genocide in Gaza, and reports about the use of automation in the US-Israel war on Iran. But could you set the scene for us as to the current state of play when it comes to the use of automation in warfare?
Yes, certainly. Actually, there's a long history of automation in place. So the grandfather of cybernetics, Norbert Wiener, worked on automation for military purposes in the 1940s and 50s and further on in the 60s until he realized that his expertise leads to some rather devastating human consequences. But the desire to automate warfare really stems or has its infancy or point of origin in the 1940s and 50s. So it is really nothing particularly new. Fast forward to today, what we're seeing are a lot more autonomous type of systems. So away from this pre-programmed sequence, if this happened, then this should happen, and more and more towards self-learning systems. And that happened, of course, from the 1950s onwards with a lot of government funding for military projects, which supported really a budding computational industry, which transferred into the civilian domain, but remained prominent in the military environment. And even autonomous weapon systems go back all the way to the 1970s. The current iteration of AI warfare and autonomous weapons systems are then not new at all. They're just a different iteration of what emerged from this particular moment when cybernetics really took hold and then became accelerated with drone warfare and became much more prominent today when computational processing power expanded and became more ubiquitous, you know, as a kind of informatic logics systems, if you will. I think perhaps it's worthwhile to situate autonomy versus automation before we begin so that we know what we're talking about. So automation really is a set of prescribed actions. For example, a toaster which pops up your toast at a specific point, which corresponds to the level of toasting that you wish that you have set it at. That's an automated system. It does the things automatically, but based on specific settings that you as a human kind of input. An autonomous system is a system that seeks and responds to further input. So it is more dynamic. It looks at feedback and takes into consideration feedback from sensor data and other kind of data and adapts to that without human intervention. And that's the shift from automation towards autonomy. So to keep with the toaster analogy, perhaps, although we might be stretching the limits here a little bit, a toaster, an autonomous toaster, for example, would be one that is, let's say, artificial intelligence enabled and works with other systems to identify perhaps when your alarm is set and rings, and it would then start toasting the bread, taking into account the time it takes for you to take a shower, would calibrate or take into account the external temperature to calibrate precisely the perfect level of toasting. Of course, you as the human would still have to input what constitutes the perfect level of toasting. Of course, that has to be programmed. And of course, you need to still put in the toaster, into the toast, into the toaster. But that would be a much more feedback-oriented type of system, which is not just automatic, but becomes increasingly autonomous because it can act and adapt based on external input. So coming back from the toaster to the military systems, a similar gradient of technological systems in new and emerging defense technologies is in place there as well. So what we're seeing is more and more of a shift towards this full autonomy systems, as I've mentioned, and specifically in the application of lethal force. So there's a different and associated gradient of capabilities at work here as well, which has developed over time and which increasingly displaces the human from the decision loop. So here we bring in the loop as a figure, if you will. So the human in the loop of decision making becomes the human on the loop of decision making, so removed ever more. And then eventually out of the loop, that's the typical terminology, from semi-autonomous or automated to semi-autonomous to fully autonomous. And so then we talk about this transition or this shift as we look towards the development of drones, from drone warfare to fully autonomous type of systems. We consider, for example, systems like Maven Smart Systems and AI decision support systems, which again is semi-autonomous. So the human is somewhere in the loop or on the loop, moving, however, towards, again, a fully autonomous systems. And all of that relates to the question of, to what degree does the human have meaningful oversight and control? And that, with greater autonomy, decreases. So it's a bit of a trade-off there. So if we look at AI decision support systems, for example, like Maven Smart Systems, but also Lavender, that was used in Gaza with devastating effects. So what we're talking about here, what we have here is not an autonomous weapon as such. Rather, it is an AI system which suggests possible targets in a particular area for human operators to approve or disapprove, and then action. So here the human is still the one technically in the loop, making the decision to direct lethal force onto a target. Those systems then gather and assess, analyze large troves of data from various sources. That can be demographic data, social network data, radio data, behavioral data, communications data, and so on. And based on that, the system will suggest a target that fits a pre-stipulated or pre-determined category of suspect or suspicious behavior. Or a system increasingly might also discover what might constitute suspicious behavior, normal behavior or abnormal behavior, based on certain input parameters or the contextualization and analysis of certain data. And it does so at very high speeds and at very large scale. The focus in both the genocidal actions in Gaza and in Iran became about scale of targeting, about not running out of targets, about finding or producing targets at a fast rate, so that the operators then found themselves in an environment where they have to cognitively keep pace with all of these suggestions. 50 targets per hour, you know, moving towards 100 targets per hour, and so on and so forth. We've seen this particularly in the case of Iran, where the big boast was that 1,000 targets were struck in 24 hours and 11,000 targets in 3 weeks and so on and so forth. It becomes an obsession with large numbers warfare enabled through computational systems. And that in turn then leaves very little time for deliberation, for double checking whether the system's information is accurate. And importantly, the process becomes prioritized and humans become the executors, if you will, of machine logics and machine decisions. And that in turn, of course, delimits the scope for overriding a computational output or for making a decision not to act on a recommendation that you have to action somehow at fast pace. And so in some ways, you kind of, even though it is a semi-autonomous system, you kind of have a quasi-autonomous weapon systems in which the human becomes this functional element in a computational environment, tasked with approving the targets at a ever-accelerated rate, with less information, with pre-digested information. So it becomes about the workflow environment. And so the types of automated, or rather, you know, the shift towards autonomous type of warfare happens systemically, if you will. So if we look at some of the promotional material that Palantir puts out in a recent industry event, the chief digital AI officer of the US, Cameron Stanley, sort of explained the system and, you know, it becomes very much about, as he was saying, all you need to do is left-click, right-click, left-click. Magically, the data becomes a detection. And then once you have a detection, the system then becomes a one-stop shop for a full targeting workflow where the system can identify the best asset in the region and then potentially also action the detected target. And as he says, then close the kill chain. Like, killing people is the same as raising, processing, and closing an IT ticket or something of the sort. So targets, including human targets or targets with human in them, in such a workflow process then become very fully digitized ultimately, so that they can be optimized for swift action, which again raises a big question of oversight, of restraint, of human interference with the system or human control over a system. But more importantly, the process of the application of violence becomes depersonalized and dehumanized, a kind of a workflow fantasy of frictionless lethality, you know. But it really is a very far abstraction from the realities what it actually means to close a kill chain, especially when such systems are working within, let's say, urban environments where data is scarce, where things are messy, where, you know, things are not easily foreseeable. So this abstraction really takes us far away from an imagination or being able to understand the long-term consequences of social, political, legal implications of using such systems in human contexts, basically out of sight, out of mind, a dream of smooth workflow efficiency. So that really is the aim. Well, we're not there yet, but that is the aim. And those are the systems that are already used and trialed in live conflicts. So really the envisioned future, at least the future envisioned by industry from what I'm hearing, takes the human increasingly nominally, because the human will remain in the decision chain in some form, out of the decision and action chain. And we're seeing a shift towards speed and scale in targeting, greater autonomy all around, whether that's navigating drone swarms or in targeting, and really focusing and coalescing around the idea of machine speed as the primary value, if you will, or parameter around which everything else has to configure. And that is not just the case in the US. We are seeing this in the UK quite starkly developing at the moment. There's a prioritization of the digital targeting web, of speeding and scaling up targeting, without really asking too many questions about what that means for how we envision warfare or the end of warfare to materialize. But the bottom line is, so it is no longer just automation towards autonomy, and that is achieved through a combination of various systems, AI-enabled systems, systems of systems always, a collection of data, data analytics platforms, weapon platforms, drones or otherwise, and all of that is then packaged together in a multi-domain ecology of command and control, which I think provides what I think is an illusion of global oversight and control at speed.
Brilliant. Thank you. That is really comprehensive. And so you've sort of started to touch on my next question a little bit. And so with this notion of sort of speed, with the notion of targeting, sort of the shift from automation to autonomy. So if we think about the technology itself, the sort of the specificity of the technology itself, how does this technology, this automated, autonomous AI technology, change the way wars are now being fought? With sort of, you know, can we think sort of more, what is actually now happening on the battlefield? Where is the battlefield? You know, how can we reconfigure our understanding of war?
Yeah, I think perhaps I will again preface this with the fact that, and it is a fact, wars remain about the destruction of bodies and things. Wars will always be about bombing, exploding things. It will be about violence ultimately. That is not going to change, regardless of what kinds of weapon systems or types of technologies we throw into the mix. War is always a political and social affairs, and so it will be about humans. And to impose your will onto another human context, destruction will always remain, and violence will always remain the perceived tool towards that end. But what is likely to change is the human's relationship to administering this violence with that technology. And what will also change is what I think is a likely cognitive shift and a different type of compartmentalization for justifying the use of force on other humans. So really a much greater distancing and dissociation mediated through screens, interfaces, and the idea that you can see everything that you have if you have just enough data. However, what we're seeing at the moment is that you can have all the data you wish to have. It will never be enough. You will never really fully understand the human context because some of the human affairs cannot be captured easily as data points. So you end up with systems that gives you a lot of information, yet you know nothing. So that's the preface. Now, there's a long history of this trajectory as well, right? So automation comes out of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But the idea or the desire to want to know human context through computational systems also has a longer history and a longer trajectory. So this desire for more precision and knowledge and the illusion that that can be gained through computational processes certainly became much more foregrounded since the Vietnam War, where computational logics played a much greater role. And so in many ways, what we're seeing today quite starkly bears the heritage of the quantification obsession of the Vietnam War policy. So it really was with the introduction of computational logics and the budding behavioral sciences that this desire to see human affairs like systems, right, to understand humans as though they're physics or some other types of systems that you can control and interfere into, that really became foregrounded during that time. And there's perhaps something to be said, and that's a side track, about the desire to mediate the application of violence or the manipulation of humans through computational systems that comes out of perhaps a hugely traumatic World War II environment, but also the use of nuclear weapons and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But that's maybe a longer story. But there was a kind of like a predecessor, if you will, of some of those data analytics companies, like Palantir, for example, in the 60s. The company was called Simulmatics. I was just reading Jill Lepore's If Then book about that. And the system really, it was a company, of course. They sought to gather data and information about the population in Vietnam and process this data in order to figure out how to influence the outcomes of the war. Ultimately, they wanted to sort of, you know, figure out who's on which side, in order to, you know, win over hearts and minds. Or indeed, the desire was to calculate when the war would finally be won and how it could best be won. Of course, all of that failed spectacularly. And the way the data was gathered was really shoddy and displayed a complete misunderstanding of what humans are all about and what it means to speak to humans and gather data from humans. And we know, of course, that the Vietnam War bore a absolutely horrific human cost. But a similar data logic is at work today. with more processing power. And of course, perhaps an even more entrenched understanding or misunderstanding of war as an engineering problem or human affairs as an engineering problem. So in many ways, the change in practices of warfare is always about the humans, not the technology itself. Technologies do not make war better or necessarily fundamentally change what war is. Rather, they channel possible actions in war in different ways. And the current shift towards autonomy with artificial intelligence has a number of consequences, or has a number of iterations or manifestations, if you will. So what characterizes the current wars is this prioritization of speed, the allure, of course, of AI-enabled weapon systems, lethal or otherwise, is that they can execute tasks much faster, including lethal action, but also finding targets, producing targets, and so on and so forth. That's an acceleration of previous capacities in quite significant way. The second allure is that of scale. That's on account of the technological capability, the potential for ubiquitous surveillance, the potential for large-scale data crunching and processing. And then that is packaged together with the potential of applying lethal force at greater scales much faster. And what is also changing is really the role the human comes to play in all of this configuration, and what they can ultimately know about the context within which the violence is applied, or what they want to know about the context within which violence is applied. AI is ultimately, if we think about the technology itself, AI is ultimately designed to marginalize human cognition, right? You can say, some might say that it enhances human cognition, but in some ways it replaces human cognition simply on account of speeding up the cognitive action associated with decision-making in warfare. So the role of the human in this task of making a decision about the use of lethal force, about targeting, about destroying, which always includes or traditionally has included a responsibility to make a moral judgment, right? To render judgment about whether one could morally justify the application of violence in any context, which is the most fraught decision and never should be taken lightly or outsource in any kind of way. But the role of the human decision maker in being able to render this judgment, make this judgment, and take moral responsibility becomes all the more marginalized. The human decision point or judgment point becomes in itself technified, or becomes fully technical in this configuration. And that changes, of course, the relationship to what it means to action lethal targeting decisions. Now, we all know that the human in warfare is not particularly benevolent or filled with restraint. It's not a moral endeavor, warfare. It is a horrific, horrific enterprise to be engaged in. This is no shade to the military profession, but the fact is that this is an awful endeavor, yes, where human lives are always at stake and human communities will always be destroyed and civilians will always bear the brunt of this action. But so taking the human out of this could be perceived, and this is often the argument, could be perceived as an improvement, right? So dispassionate application of violence is perhaps better than the passionate, ideologically inflected, racially motivated hatred that is produced through humans. But the human doesn't really go away, but rather the application of force is diffused, the responsibility of the application of force is diffused. And without human awareness in the engagement chain, the possibility for moral restraint, the possibility for not making a lethal decision, the possibility for doing the unobvious, the possibility for not killing ultimately shrinks considerably. And that is important. And additionally, what we're seeing is really an expansion of the logic of surveillance, the possibility to survey populations in ever more pervasive ways, a shift towards a dehumanization of humans as data objects under this fiction that human life can be datafied, drawing everything into the wake of an instrumental logic, a shift towards killing as a process, routed through the logics of information technology workflow management processes. And related to that, a real diffusion or perhaps a rerouting of the significance of what it means to take responsibility for one's actions in war. And then a final point I want to perhaps mention is there's a significant new issue in how the new defense technology industry and its associated financial interests might shape which kinds of practices of warfare are prioritized on account of the types of technologies that scale very well as businesses and that scale fastest as businesses, because that's where the money can be made. And this is something I have been trying to keep an eye on in the last 2 years. And there's been a concentrated shift really in the last decade or so to foreground artificial intelligence and computational systems and software as the key to solving the problem of war, as the way to win wars swiftly. These are literally things that you know, new defense technology companies have said. You know, wars will now be won with code, or will they be solved with code? And that in itself produces some trends that are worth noting. The prioritization, of course, of these data analytics platforms that connect data from all domains, sea, air, land, space, cyber, and so on, ideally globally, to provide a command and control platform that then gives the illusion that everything suspicious can be detected and actioned at speed across the globe. And that, you know, the US has instituted a program called the Joint All Domain Command and Control, JADC2 program, for which the model was Uber, the platform. And so together with that came the prioritization of cheaper drone systems, from loitering munitions to first-person view drones to so-called attritable drone systems, thousands of drones that are used in conflict to overwhelm the enemy, to produce what is called a hellscape in the lingo of the US Department of Defense. And that focuses attention onto mass, and that is to say scale. So speed and scale introduced by, yeah, Silicon Valley ideologies, but also the ethos, really. The ethos of Silicon Valley startups has been brought into the military domain. So this notion of move fast and break things. And this has then foregrounded certain capabilities that this industry is really good at. But the upshot of all of this is that it also has also foregrounded lethality as a main mode of addressing conflict, because that is what these systems enable.
Thank you. And that actually moves into my next question quite nicely. So weaponry, military technology has always evolved. You know, we can trace genealogies of all different types of weapon systems across time. At the same time, you've also been telling us that sort of automation and the move towards autonomy has perhaps a longer history than people are aware of in popular culture. I think the way that this kind of technology is presented to us currently is that this is a huge break. This is really different. This is something new. So my question then to you is sort of, does it really represent a fundamental change, or can we think of it more in terms of continuity?
It is absolutely a continuity. I mean, there are some fundamental changes when we look at the types of techniques that are used for artificial intelligence that is different than the early days of artificial intelligence in the 1950s and 1960s. The technology itself is, you know, it has its origins in cybernetic technologies coming out of the 50s. The first workshop on artificial intelligence was instituted, or by the field as a field of inquiry, but also as a technology and technique. Data processing was sort of inaugurated, was in 1956. There are different techniques now when we look at the large language models, transformer models that process data differently. But the ethos of all of this really has this longer history, and it is a continuity. And in some ways, even though there are some interesting, if you want to use that word, innovations in various technologies that come out of the civilian sector and have then transferred in back into the military sector, right? So it's a bit of a loop that is going on, because, of course, the software industry and Silicon Valley comes and was largely supported by military research or military grants or military funding. That kind of provided the backbone for what we see as Silicon Valley today. And now, the technologies having developed in a civilian space in Silicon Valley are introduced back into the military domain. So this is an interesting kind of like circular environment. But they're not really that new. And I'm trying to convey that to people who try to get their heads around it. And because they're not that new, we can also think a little bit about how the technologies relate to us as humans and our cognitive ability and our human agency. Some of the texts coming out of the 50s, again, Norbert Wiener has written about this, but a number of other philosophers as well, have really put their finger on the core problem that we are grappling with today. And that is the relationship between these different agencies, right? The human agency, which is very different than a computational agency, because we as humans, even though, you know, the systems, AI systems are modeled in some ways on neural pathways in our brains, we as humans are not computers, and we don't function like computers. So there's a tension always in this interaction in that space between the human and machine teaming. But again, the ethos has had a much longer trajectory. We can even go as recent as the 2010s and the drone warfares, right? So the desire for drones for targeted killing comes out of the 80s when terrorism was seen as a big problem. And wouldn't it be great if we could just, like, you know, assassinate individual guys? That was frowned upon in the 80s. And the technology, as it advanced, drone technology over the 90s and into the 2000s, made it possible to target individuals in ways that it was not possible before. And that allowed the norms to shift. And targeting became not a frowned upon practice of assassination, which the international community was certainly not in favor of, but rather it became a practice that was instituted with the capability of the drone and advanced capabilities and more sophisticated technological systems. Lots of the technologies that we're seeing, even in AI decision support systems, is not new. The current iteration of these AI decision support systems also comes very clearly out of the 2000s, 2010 algorithmic warfare practice, which arose in tandem with drone warfare and targeted killing. So the notion that you can identify threats based on certain profiles, on behavioral patterns, on patterns of life analysis, that was born out of that time in the 2000s and 2010, where we were talking about signature strikes, but also personality strikes. But signature strikes then were, again, frowned upon to a certain degree. It's become the norm, right? That we understand or accept that if you have data, you can identify what constitutes the profile of a suspect, which, again, is potentially an illusion. But the technological advancements have gone hand in hand with the desire of what would be a great thing to have. And with that, norms have gradually shifted. And that's quite problematic. And specifically, it has shifted towards how we see the world, as a system, as a territory of data, as a set of objects that can be manipulated, optimized, intervened into for improvement. And this is ultimately what my first book, my only book to date, Death Machines, is all about. An institution of an ethos, a biopolitical ethos, a necropolitical ethos, rather, or aspiration to improve one's context through the use of violent technologies, so through the use of technological systems, but also through the use of technological logics. The fiction always is that with all this data, war can finally become precise and controllable, which of course is not bearing out at all. Rather, what seems to bear out is an expansion of violence as the technology gives the illusion of control. But there is something in this configuration of humans working with being co-constituted by technologies. And so I think it's important to look beyond the idea that we use technologies as instruments, which is very prevalent in the military context, right? So, oh, we have this wonderful technology, we make use of it, and we control the technology. That's really challenging in this contemporary configuration. A lot of philosophers of technology have argued that any kind of technology is always more than a simple tool, even a gun or a tank or a missile. It has attributes that foreground certain perspectives and practice, while it just lets other things disappear, makes other things or other options less prominent or visible. And it really goes back to the old saying, as simple as it is, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So material objects are never just tools that we use at our leisure or direct with our willful capacities, but that technology always, especially today's technologies, has the ability to produce new ways of thinking, has the ability to normalize new practices that hitherto had not been acceptable or, you know, had been frowned upon. There's always a certain level of interest and power designed into systems. And with AI systems, that is even more pronounced because humans are embedded much more deeply within these systems, not just physically, but cognitively as well. So the systems themselves take on a much more pronounced agentic capacity in shaping our ideas, practices, perspectives, and possibilities, and so on. And even more so as we begin to see more large language models find their way into defense products. The future of all of that is, you know, having to deal with autonomous AI agents in the defense domain. Of course, the design always matters. In the early days, when I started speaking on this topic and started researching this topic, I always like to point out our growing dependency, of course, on smartphones and our computational environment and the phantom pain that you feel when your phone is not at hand or the prompts that you, the urges that you have when you see a red dot somewhere or a message appear that, you know, produces a certain impulse or prioritization to immediately respond to a visual cue and so on. So we must assume that this condition, our human reaction to these kinds of interfaces, the relationship that we have to the technology, that holds for the military context as well. So it is important how things are designed, which very often isn't interrogated at all. So technologies shape cognition or direct cognition, if you will, and from that practices are established or they are normalized. And so then the question becomes, especially for a technology that is particularly good at speed and scale and efficiency and optimization. And if this technology then is used for lethal outcomes, the question is, what happens? What happens in this context? What can we expect to become normalized? And at the moment, really, it is a shift towards large-scale violence and greater lethality. It really raises also the question whether such wars can ever end at all or whether they will simply perpetuate more wars and more conflict.
Elke, your work, and you've already started to introduce us to this. Your work has importantly focused on the ethics of all of this. And so what are the main ethical concerns with automation, with the move towards autonomy? And can these be disentangled from the technology itself, or are these something actually also intrinsic to warfare more generally? Can you, you know, maybe talk to us a little bit more about the ethics of what we see happening today?
Yeah. I mean, this is the core of my work in the last decade, although I've shifted a little bit more into political economy, but it was motivated by being interested in what the broadest ethical consequences are of this new AI-shaped, you know, landscape in defense and for the use of semi-autonomous and autonomous kinds of lethal systems. And it really is a big topic, so I can only scratch the surface a little bit, but there are many, many ethical issues that arise, and it is a fundamental moral questions of what we are doing with introducing these kinds of violence here. There are ethical issues that arise simply at the technical level, right? So artificial intelligence is fallible in so many ways. It is unreliable in so many ways. Any AI system is only ever as good as the data it has been trained on or the data it works with. AI systems tend to be they need to be updated relatively frequently. Data is not easy to come by for contexts of conflict, which are dynamic, messy, you know, swiftly changing. So there's an intrinsic brittleness and vulnerability in the use of artificial intelligence to produce greater automation and autonomy in weapon systems. Introducing large language models, we all know about hallucinations and the fact that these are not human systems. They are probabilistic systems that compute the next possible, you know, token or part of a word or a sentence. So there's no understanding, there's no meaning, but there's a lot of vulnerabilities. You can spoof a large language model by just introducing 250 different poisoned documents. So there's so much capacity for something going wrong simply on account of the technical level. And of course, in the context of warfare, this harm that comes to pass through this risk, this sheer technological risk, is borne by civilians. That is passed on to civilians. There's a broader ethical issue on account of the dominant technological logics that I have already indicated. When any context becomes a system of digitizable objects, which can be and should be controlled, perhaps this marginalizes, of course, the complexities of human life that do matter for decisions in warfare. It abstracts the meaning of human life from the application of violence, and that's a dissociation of this most significant moral question of what it means to take a life. And it shifts the question of, should we kill in the first place? Is this the right course of action? What for? It moves to, well, maybe we can kill better, we can kill more, and that produces a better outcome. Perhaps the most significant ethical issues, I think, on account of the human-machine interactions, in that it reduces or limits the possibility and the meaning of human responsibility. So moral agency is always delimited when humans operate with cognitive type systems. So not just physical kind of prosthesis, but cognitive prosthesis, if you will. So human responsibility, moral responsibility, and the possibility for moral restraint, which is so important in warfare, if it then must happen, you know, in order to not allow mass atrocities and mass violence to come to pass. I've written a paper with a colleague of mine, Neil Rennick, and in it we focus on this human-machine constellation, and we take issues in the ways with which the application of violence through AI-enabled systems is often presented as more humane or dispassionate or somehow better. But really, if we look at the history of the application of systematic violence and what it means to install the possibility of systemization of violence, then we must recognize that there is a link between systematization of violence and the systematic application of violence and the possibility for mass atrocities, or at the very least, the possibility for limiting moral restraint. In some ways, we always, as humans, have defenses, unless you're a psychopath, psychological defenses against the emotionless application of violence against other humans. We understand and can conceptualize what atrocity is, what, you know, exceeds moral bounds in you know, any kind of way. A system cannot do that, of course. So even when the human is embedded in these kinds of systems, the psychological defenses have to be overcome in order to scale up lethality, let's say. And again, here, if we look at the history of mass atrocities, certain enablers are always at work. One is an authorization, meaning you kind of have the ability to abdicate your responsibility because you've been authorized by some other higher entity or knowledge provider or knowledge producer to engage in a certain action. The second is a routinization, meaning you are embedded in a chain of actions where you're a part of is just one part of the workflow management process, let's say, and you're doing it over and over again. And so that too shrinks the possibility for actioning your own moral restraint, perhaps. And the third is always the biggest, that is the dehumanization. Dehumanization is almost always present when we look at the history of mass atrocities and genocide and mass violence. So what we then have is a dehumanization of the target on account of an AI system, for example, because it is an objectification in the most literal sense. An AI system cannot understand the meaning of what a human is, but rather sees the human as an object. You know, data is collected, disaggregated, re-aggregated, and people are assorted into categories that may or may not have anything to do with them as people. So everything becomes an object, not a subject. But following on from that, there's also a different kind of dehumanization at work, and the dehumanization of those applying the violence that are embedded within the systems. They become functional elements within this marginalized moral agency that is present on account of these various parameters. And all of this lowers moral restraint against violence with autonomous weapon systems or AI-enabled support systems too. This condition is part of the logical basis, right? So this being embedded in cognitively faster machines, then the technology becomes the authority. Actions become functional routines, and that shrinks the horizon for moral intervention. And then all around dehumanization enables potentially what Gentandas called the monstrous, you know, the mass extermination of other humans. So really this opens up the most significant ethical question is whether we're opening up the path towards greater violence, perhaps even in conflicts which are asymmetrical, which are grounded always as a foundation in racialized and ideological hostilities with these kinds of systems. And then finally, there are many more issues, but I want to end on this because to me, this is really important. The greatest ethical challenge is the role of ethics in these configurations itself. Increasingly, ethics becomes routed through the computational algorithmic pathways of utility reasoning that you can calculate, right? A cost-benefit analysis. Really, it's about utility. It's about checking whether you've just met certain thresholds. So ethics becomes a game of variables that you can compute and weigh and so on and so forth. And this then really replaces, you know, rigorous logical reasoning rigorous logical reasoning for taking responsibility and grappling with deep moral questions and really asking yourself, should I act or should I not act? And again, this turns the focus on who should be killed based on what calculus rather than the question of whether we should kill at all. And increasingly, it sidelines ethics as a hindrance. And I've never been asked more frequently than in the last 3 years, what use ethics is in war, right? Why should we even have ethics in war when there are so many enemies that don't really adhere to ethical guidelines? But without it, there's no future. Without it, civilization is just not possible. You know, it's quite practically a necessity for us to think about what ethics means and to think about what the meaning of human life in a social context actually is and why we have ethics.
I'm actually speechless. I mean, surely we need to think about ethics in war because war is fundamentally first and foremost a question of ethics. No, I mean, it's the first thing. Oh my goodness. Wow. All right. Whew. That's woken up our listeners if they were falling asleep. Now, you're saying your work is now sort of obviously focusing some more on political economy as well as ethics. So maybe then this also leads into this question. So the rise of automation, autonomous systems, AI, is not restricted to the military and the realm of warfare. I think anyone who works in a university knows all about the increasing role that AI plays in our life, for better or worse. So do we see crossovers between the use of automation and AI in the battle space and its use in other parts of society?
Yeah, there's a really interesting ongoing enrollment of large-scale militarization of absolutely everything underway at the moment. And this has to do with a number of things. One of the aspects that is relevant here is what I've already mentioned, and that is the idea that all human contexts are systems. It can be digitized. You can know things about other humans. And on account of that, you can assess the risks. And on account of being able to assess the risks, you can intervene and improve your context. Right. So that's not reduced to military environments. We know that most military technologies find their way into the civilian space, first and foremost, as forms of policing or as technologies of policing. And there's an interesting and very evident crossover or meshing of military types of technologies and policing technologies or logics and military logics well underway. And we see this perhaps most starkly pronounced in the United States at the moment, where you have military contractors like Palantir also provide systems for ICE, you know, for immigration enforcement purposes. But Palantir, of course, also works with the NHS in the UK and I think with the Treasury now as well. And so, yeah, technology providers that we all work with, use, have multiple government contracts usually, right? And that includes absolutely everyone. So absolutely everyone is in the business of providing their systems to the military. That is Google, that is Meta. I'm not sure about Apple, actually, but there's Amazon. So it's becoming a very totalitarian configuration almost, by especially the big tech companies, which hold the largest market cap and which are so financially powerful that they have the ability to influence and shape directions, not just of military operations, but also how we should think about crowd control, how we should think about population control. I think I was listening to the founder of Oracle speaking about his vision of the future of crowd control, where everybody has to wear some sort of camera and the police have to wear cameras and everything can be captured at all points. Right? So this fantasy of surveillance, and on account of the ability to survey absolutely everything, the illusion is created that you can understand everything and therefore you can control it. But of course you can manipulate it. There's an enormous amount of power in there. There's also a really interesting kind of revolving door in, you know, the technology company representatives or C-suite executives entering the military space, and then possibly, you know, creating a kind of like a revolving door back as well. So bringing some of these insights into a civilian space. So the US Army has created a new division. It's called Detachment 201. And this division is made up by four big tech executives. It was spearheaded by the CTO of Palantir, Shyam Sankar. And so these four big tech executives have now become army reservists, and they were sworn in at the high rank of lieutenant colonel. That gives them a lot of decision power, right? It's not just, they're not just starting from the bottom. They're coming in at a high rank. They have no army training. They don't know much about the military profession other than perhaps having a really, you know, swelling patriotic feeling for the US. I'm not entirely sure. So having been sworn in into this army context, they don't need that access in order to sell contracts or work with the army. So the question is, what is this transfer now? And what happens with the transfer back, right? Because they will remain CTOs, CEOs, chief officers of their companies in the civilian space as well. There's also a question, what happens to all of our data, right? So as we feed the beast, as we are engaging with ChatGPT and Claude and this and that and the other, the question is, does our engagement with these systems help train systems then that are then used for military purposes and then again could potentially be used in a domestic context to be thrown back at us in some sort of, you know, disadvantageous way or discriminatory way? So there's many, many ways in which we are seeing a very comprehensive revolving door. So things coming from the civilian context into the military context, but also from the military context back into a domestic control context. And of course, these types of systems always need a kind of differentiation between good and bad. And these differentiations will happen along ideological lines and racialized lines almost always. So, you know, when I started teaching my course on technology, politics, and war, and I spoke to students about, you know, what kind of suspicions they have or whether they'd be a little bit scared at all the data that they're leaving as a trail in the internet or the wider web of data repositories. And they've always said, no, 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 you know, I have nothing to hide. Very unaware that once it's out there, your data can be used in all kinds of ways and not in ways that constitute you as you, but that can produce you as a category, and you might fall into a category of suspicion.
Yeah, I think the naivety is really, really the worry here. So finally, it's always difficult to talk about future trends, but what do you see as some of the emerging and critical questions regarding automation and AI in war, but also the realm of international relations more broadly?
It's really tricky. I mean, with the encroaching militarization of absolutely everything, I think international relations has some serious challenges on its hands as a discipline to better understand the pervasiveness of militarization as a theory in itself. And also the role of technology in shaping power and concentrating power. And I think IR has maybe missed that a little bit, although there's been some amazing work in the last decade or so. But, you know, technology had not really featured into how power comes to be concentrated, even though, you know, if you read Origins of Totalitarianism, for example, the role of technology is really significant. And it was so interesting to read and go back to this text at the moment and see and read how the totalitarian fantasy of back in the 30s and 40s was precisely to know everything about everyone and see who's connected to whom in order to be able to then eradicate all the bad elements ultimately, right? So there's literally a passage in that text where Hannah Arendt explains this fantasy of understanding social networks and being able to wield power onto these social networks once you've made all the connections. So this is a really important challenge, I think, to think about not just the technologies as we have them right now and who are the big AI companies, but what is the logic of technology and how has the logic of technology shaped how politics has progressed over the last century or so, right? They have always played a role. And I think the interplay is really important to identify and grapple with in ways that we just haven't. Günther Anders has written this wonderful. So Günther Anders is a philosopher, a mid-century philosopher, a German philosopher. And he's written a number of really interesting texts where he tries to get at the role of technology, but also our products in relationship with human capabilities and limitations. And he was writing against the background of World War II, of course, but also the advent of the atomic bomb and its use and the absolute horror that had emerged from that. And he wrote an open letter to the son of Adolf Eichmann, Klaus Eichmann. And in this letter, he tries to get his head around how it was possible to produce the monstrous, he calls it, das Monströse. And he says, what happened in Nazi Germany was, of course, a political ideology. But it wasn't just about politics. It was about certain cultural roots. And these cultural roots have to do with technology and the way we relate to technology and the way we think about ourselves in relation to technology. So he says what has enabled the monstrous is these roots that we have become a technologized world. And these roots continue to exist. They persist. We haven't done away with them. And so in this text, he says, unless we recognize who we are in relation to our artifacts and our technologies and the cultural roots that have been produced through this interplay, we are very likely to see a revisitation of the types of politics that were possible, that gave rise to Nazi Germany and the mass violence that ensued with that. Because if we don't understand how it is possible for humans to become what he calls Eichmann, right? Not just active Adolf Eichmann, but passive people who are able to justify all kinds of things through technological artifacts, to mediation and a certain relationship that is created to the application of violence, then we are very well, you know, doomed to just repeat history as it is. And I found that text, I keep coming back to it. I find this text so interesting. He wrote that in the 1960s, I think, and then he wrote another letter in 1988. But really, I think we have to pay attention. It's perhaps tricky, it's perhaps more very self-evident, but there's an enormous amount of concentrated power in the hands of the technology elites at the moment. And these technology elites at the moment have considerable vested interests in this technological perspective in making us into technological agents ourselves. They have vested interests, of course, in scaling up of military spending on defense tech companies they're invested in, which have to come to fruition within the next 5 to 10 years, which is why you always see these like, oh, 2030, 2028, right? So there's certain timelines in which the investments need to bear fruit. And that is terrifying if you consider the general perspectives and ideologies of some of these individuals and the ideologies that some of the companies also present. It's always almost a type of an apocalyptic perspective in which everything is zero sum and which everything is about extinction or survival. And with this perspective, the build out of ever more defensive and military type spending is always justified. I come back to, you know, the thing that we learn early on in our career as IR scholars, and that's the security dilemma, right? I feel like we haven't really learned much in the current context about what the security dilemma is, and that you the more you build up your military arsenal and the more you threaten to build up your military arsenal, the more likely it is that you end up in a conflict, that you end up using this. And I'm terrified at the moment that we are sliding into a willful build out of military capabilities, which will then maybe produce a certain urgency to use the things that we have amassed. And that, of course, you know, sidelines the horrors of war, that sidelines, and we see this in the Ukraine. I think the horrors of war in the Ukraine are very often sidelined in favor of talking about how fantastic drones are. But really, that if you look at the number of amputees, if you look at the number of devastated communities, if you look at the number of displaced people, if you look at the number of sheer human death that has been inflicted, and if you speak to people who had to fight this war, you know, in Ukraine for survival, they will say, this is awful. We want this to end. We don't want this to be perpetuated. So I think, you know, looking into the future, I mean, obviously we need to regulate the development and use of autonomous weapons and AI systems like now. You know, we have to regulate them. We can't leave it to industry to just sort of do the right thing. But we need to certainly think a little bit harder about what it means to maintain peace or to not have conflict, or to solve conflict without violence. You know, promote diplomatic ties, just find ways to trust rather than mistrust one another. Because if we build our future on the logic of an economy that is built on wartime principles, and if we bet on economic growth through defense spending, and if we bet on security purely through a buildup of more AI type lethal systems, then I think that heads us into a potentially quite a violent future. All the while, you know, there's not really, these are not really wars that can be won, right? We're seeing no decisive victory anywhere. In fact, we're seeing just a greater mess, greater geopolitical instability. But the winners of all of this, those that capitalize on the ever-growing defense technology environment or defense environment at large. I mean, if you look at the stock prices of even the defense primes, you know, it's going through the roof. And of course, all the investors are now thinking, well, maybe I should invest in defense products, which was something that was frowned upon only 5 years ago as well. So I think looking to the future, we need to think much harder about how to maintain stability without the use of violence.
I think that's a fantastic place to end this episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Arka, and like fantastic discussion and a lot for, I think, our listeners, for myself also, to take away and to think about. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.